You all know, you have it emblazoned in your brain because I've said it 40,000 times. What's happening? Right, we're reviving the LA chapter of Reasons to Believe, and Warren is definitely going to be there. I want to, it'll be at about 12:40 or as soon as we can get it going, but I want to ask Mark to come up, who is the president of the LA chapter, to say a couple of things.
Get some badges, you know, like they wear in the banana republics, where they have their generals and their presidents, they have all the big things across the chest.
Like on Blazing Saddles?
Yeah, like that. What we're going to do after class today, about 10 minutes after the class clears, to allow the people who need to purge to go ahead and leave. But we're going to have an RTB Los Angeles chapter business meeting. And what we'll do in the business meeting is, for those who want to become members, we'll have a statement of faith we'll issue, so you can read what the statement of faith is, sign it, and become a member. And then we're going to have the officer elections. My plan is to spend about 20 minutes, and not much longer than that, unless it takes much longer than that. But I want to get it done quickly. That will be the business meeting that will precede the operations meetings, which will occur later on, like another month or so down the road. So, when you're done here, if you want to be part of the chapter, stick around. If not, please take your visiting outside or just in the corner so it doesn't interrupt the rest of the meeting. Please, go ahead.
When will the duties begin for the offices?
Immediately, as soon as the election is done. We'll actually have little ballots, and we'll put them up there on the piano when we're done, and we'll have somebody count them.
Operations of the chapter, when will they begin?
Probably within the next month, when we have another meeting. The people who are the chapter officers, there's four different titles. Each one has a different segment of the operation to do, and then they'll form committees or teams. I prefer teams than committees. Committees don't get anything done. Teams, there's a leader, and then there's people who actually work to get things done. That's the plan. Was that responsive to your question?
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm taking a trip after I move. So.
Well, come back. The meetings will be continued. So if people want to join later on, that's fine. It doesn't have to be done today. But we want to get it started today.
Mark, can you say something about what your vision for the chapter is?
I can, but I'd rather do it afterwards, because then
Okay. Everybody
who's going to be here, I don't want to burn up your time.
Fair enough. Okay.
Yeah. Any other questions before I hand it over to the real speaker? Okay. Thank you.
I am. Okay, you still hear me?
Yeah.
Tim Boyle, you don't know me, but I've read a lot of your stuff on the Apologist website. I'm glad you're here. It's good to meet you. I was even thinking of going to Japan once just to shake your hand. So.
Go do it right now.
He's a brilliant guy. I want to clear one thing up. You ever have these things where you think you know what it's going to be, and it's just this tiny little detail, and you can't seem to settle it? Okay, so the issue is the starting of the Skeptics Forum coming up on Sunday. When have I said it's going to start? And when was I saying before Carol was bugging me about it? I kept saying 11:15, right? Well, I found out this week that the class that's in Pritchard Hall before we get started very much wants us to start at 11:15 because they can't get out of there. So, in a very subtle way, okay, I need to let you guys know when the start of the Skeptics Forum is, okay? Now, when is it going to be? Okay. Can anybody tell me? Okay. Tell me again? Okay. Is there any doubt? All right. Tell me when the Skeptics Forum is going to start. All right? All right. You have it in your head now? All right. How's that for a graphic? Did you like that? Look at this. Watch this one. This is cool. Watch. All right. So when is the Skeptics Forum? That was the most annoying background I could find. They're dead fish.
But some of us will be there at 11.
Yes, you will. Okay.
I was going to order after 11.
Yeah, well, there's some people that just don't get the obvious, Alan. All right. I thought I'd have about an hour and a half, but I'm going to have 45 minutes, and in 45 minutes, we are going to talk about nothing. You guys have probably wanted this all along. What's that?
All four different kinds of nothing?
Yeah, well, that's right. I'm going to talk about nothing. So if someone asks you, what did Ross teach about, what are you going to say? If he said, if that's right. If they ask you, was it interesting, you can say, nothing is interesting. What was interesting about it? Absolutely nothing. Well, if they say, would I have liked it? You can say, well, if you can fill your head with nothing, you would have liked it. So why is nothing so fascinating? They would say, and you can say, to solve the problem of existence, you must have a deep understanding of nothing. Okay. All of this is inspired by this book that I introduced to the class a couple of weeks ago that I really, really liked. It's the most fun I've ever had reading a philosophy book. It's called Why Does the World Exist? By a guy named Jim Holt. This guy is not a believer, but he does not diss it either. He's a writer looking for the answers, and it's probably the most intellectually honest and a little bit irreverent look at why is there something rather than nothing. I highly, highly recommend it. It's a lot of fun. Why Does the World Exist? Jim Holt.
Holt.
Holt. You're having trouble this morning, aren't you, Alan? Before the Big Bang, there was nothing. What's wrong with that statement? Nothing. Great. Boy. I trained you too well. Actually, there is something wrong with that statement. Before the Big Bang, there was nothing. What's all right? What does before imply?
But you don't know that because you weren't there.
Well, I've never been to Madagascar either, but I know it's there. Yeah. Okay.
Well, there was no before if we didn't have linear time.
Because what came into existence with the beginning of the universe?
Matter.
And?
Time.
And time. All right? So, to say that there was something before the universe began is a nonsensical statement. Because before implies time, there was no time, according to science, before anything began. We hope so. Yes, that's right. Now, does anybody know why, can you say it in a sentence or two, why did time not exist before the universe? From a scientific...
There was no time when there was no time.
There was nothing.
There was nothing as part of this universe.
That's right.
Different dimensions.
A scientific time. Why was there no time? At some moment there was the singularity. Okay? What we believe was the beginning of the universe, the Big Bang.
The moment is a point in time.
Why could there not have been any time at the moment of the singularity? I know I keep talking in terms of time, but it's the only words we have to make sense of this. What is it about relativity that tells us that there could be no passage of time at the moment of the singularity?
Well, is it because it was the beginning?
No.
But doesn't matter and energy have something to do with it?
Now you're saying something that makes sense. Yeah.
Yes.
according to relativity, time slows down under a really huge gravitational field. The gravitational field at the moment of the singularity would have been so almost infinite, time would basically freeze. It would stop. So there is no passage of time during the at the moment of the singularity. Now, I was making a lot of jokes about nothing. Is nothing an entity? Is nothing a thing? What is it? And what is and what is everything? Well, if you have zero on a timeline, is that something? It's still a number. And it implies a number system. So there's a there is something there represented by zero.
Well, zero is greater than negative one, so zero doesn't necessarily mean.
So is negative one something?
Yes.
Okay.
Of course it is.
It's my IQ sometimes. Okay. I want to go through some of the definitions that he talks about what is nothing. It's actually a harder concept to grab a hold of than you think. Hughes talked about it in this class, and he's never talked about it in depth, so I thought it might be fun to really look into when science says there was nothing before the universe started, what exactly are we talking about? So let's have some fun with this. Macbeth from Shakespeare. Nothing is, but what is not? Is there anything wrong with that statement?
No.
Nothing is, but what is not? Okay, does that imply that you're comparing nothing to something? So it sort of implies that there's already something which you're subtracting from. Okay, I'm not trying to answer these definitively, okay? I just want to run these by, get you guys thinking about this stuff. Here's a dictionary definition. Nothing, noun, a thing that does not exist. What's wrong with that? Okay, a thing. Is it a thing? Is it a thing even that doesn't exist? It's a what? It's a concept, but doesn't a concept imply something?
So is that definition an oxymoron?
Yes. Yes. A thing that does not exist. Again. Right. Here it is. A poor man has it, a rich man needs it, and if you eat it for a long time, it'll kill you. Nothing. Okay. Had to put that in for Alan. Okay. This guy was a minister, John Donne. The less anything is, the less we know it. How invisible, how unintelligible a thing then is this nothing. Is dark matter, if all there was in the universe was dark matter, would there be nothing?
No.
Right. Okay, so name all the things that aren't there in nothing.
Space between dark matter.
Space is something.
Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that space is something. It can be empty space. If we took everything that existed out of the universe, the space is still there to contain it. Okay? Yes. Well, maybe as close as we can get to it. Yeah. Okay.
How about the average temperature in the universe?
Well, that implies that there is something to be measured, temperature.
Right, so the average coldness would be nothing because there's cold and hot.
But that implies some kind of temperature, warmth, something to be measured. That's something.
And there's nothing that's absolute zero. Okay.
Okay. Martin Heidegger, anxiety reveals the nothing. This is a little more personal, and I'm going to get back to this. What is it? Without God, what is it we worry about?
Nothing.
A lot of nothing. This one is absurd. It's ridiculous. But if you read it, this is where science has to go with it. Nothing is a vacuum force. That's right. Sucking things into non-existence or keeping them there. If this force acts upon itself, it sucks nothingness into nothingness, producing something or perhaps everything. Wow. You need a PhD to write that, I think.
Who is Robert Mitchell?
A scientist, but I don't know. Or a philosopher, I mean. Yes.
I was trying to relate a body being sucked into the black hole, and then it's no longer a body. It's just, you know, atom.
But if there's a black hole, then that implies all the stuff that's in the black hole, and it implies physical laws that govern what's in the black hole.
Yeah.
So you're not to nothing.
But I'm thinking the complete body would not be nothing.
The body would, Alan.
Well, this is an old analogy, but if a tree falls in the forest and makes a noise, and nobody's there to hear it, doesn't make a noise.
Yes.
Yeah. Maybe I said another brilliant thing. I don't know. But the thing is, maybe not. So, would that be related to the nothing? I mean, if you don't, you can't see nothing, right? I mean, or can you? If you can see it, it's something. So if you can't see it, it's nothing. So, but to describe nothing has to be something you can't see. So therefore, and that's the way it is.
No.
I don't know.
Okay. That was brilliant. Well, it was really nothing, but. All right.
Nothing before the Big Bang?
That's correct.
I don't see how anybody could think that. That seems wrong to me.
Well, that's kind of where we're going.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I agree with you. Alexander Luria. Yes,
is that
Mark.
Ex nihilo.
Ex nihilo, yeah. This is a sort of a personal statement of him. He's another philosopher. In order for me to grasp the meaning of a thing, I have to see it. Many of us are like that. I have a visual mind. Take the word nothing. I see this nothing, and it is something. So I turned to my wife, and I asked her what nothing meant. She simply said, nothing means there's nothing, like Susan said. I understood it differently. I saw this nothing. If nothing can appear to a person, that means it's something. That's where the trouble comes in.
What is faith?
What is faith? It is something.
Can you see it?
No. And we're getting there. We're going to go there. Yes? Nothing is important. Yes. Bede Rundle. This one has so many problems with it, you can't even list them. Listen to this one. If there were nothing, then it would have been a fact that there was nothing. So at least one thing would exist after all, that fact. What's wrong with that?
His premise.
Say something.
A fact doesn't exist apart from a cognitive being to declare it a fact.
That's right. A fact can't exist. The idea of a fact has to exist in a universe with conscious minds that understand what that is. Dan? Yes, you're right.
No,
you're right.
I mean, before the Grecian man, there was no cognitive being.
Right.
So it was still fact.
Other than I'm talking within the bounds of secular science, how they're thinking about it. They would say, yeah.
Before we were created, there was no cognitive beings to think about it in terms of fact, but there were still facts.
Right. Mark, read this one. What do you think of that? Is that a brilliant statement? The philosopher laughs. Yeah.
What is pain?
Well, let me go there, because I'm going to get to all that, the non-material stuff. I want to talk about that. Ted?
Every one of these statements is full of minefields, because it's all about how we define words. Like, how do we define the word fact? You made the statement that facts would not exist if there were no conscious beings to know them. But a scientist would say a fact is information. And information is embedded in DNA or chemistry or whatever that does not require a conscious mind to understand it.
So if you had a universe that was entirely devoid of everything, completely vacant, would there be a fact? Would there be a fact that it was vacant?
Right. Yes. Well, that's what he's saying.
That's what he's saying, and I don't buy it. Okay. So, John.
There
would be a fact that it was bacon, but only outside of that reality. So getting our minds around what nothing is difficult as imagining different dimensions that we'll never be able to experience.
So if you take, yes, if you take if you take reality as we know it, and you take away time, energy, matter, space, that's as close as we can get to thinking about what nothing would be like. But then you're left with, what about things that seem to be transcendent of that? Would mathematics still exist? Does mathematics just describe what we see, or is there something transcendent about math? There seems to be, when you do math, it seems like this would apply everywhere, anywhere, in any universe. It works almost like it's bigger than reality. It's almost like it's God's language. Right.
Yeah, but it wasn't there before the Big Bang.
Well,
or what?
If the Big Bang was started out, it's a singularity. Where did the physical laws come from that define all the parameters of the space-time when it exploded? Where did those physical laws come from? Where did those parameters come from? Were they before?
God.
Were they built in somewhere?
Didn't it come from the matter, the space, the time?
But
when there's an explosion. The explosion created those dimensions, right? I guess.
I think what we might be talking about when we say nothing is the characteristics of our universe that didn't exist. But if there was a creator, and the universe reflects the nature of the creator, then it could well be that mathematics existed within the mind of the but it is beyond the scope of what is now in our universe.
That's very good. You're leading me by about 5 minutes. That's good, Martin.
Yeah, just a quick statement. If there were multiple dimensions, I mean there are, we don't know how many. Then even when we did not exist, our universe. There was still something which meant
there's still something.
Going back to the mathematics, there could be another way of thinking of it as mathematics explains what happens naturally. So, like, you could, if you're doing archery and you're shooting a bow, you can use mathematics and calculate exactly how far you have to pull it back, what angle, to get to go where you want to go. Or you can have just practiced archery a lot and just know how far to pull back to get to go where you need it to go without missing it.
So if we had an entirely empty universe, no matter energy, space, time, would 2 plus 2 still equal 4?
Only if it was defined that way. But you can define it in itself. It's just nothing to define.
John?
Matter, in and of itself, is more than a tinker toy. Matter cannot innately create its own set of laws in physics. No more than a tinker toy set can develop laws of its own. Okay? So any laws governing nature have to precede nature. But laws only exist in a mind, a being that could bring those laws to have an effect on the new creation that he just created. So in other words, you had to have something transcend to begin. Something, someone, some mind that exists before the singularity to bring singularity.
What do you mean exactly when you say singularity? Is that the
initial explore?
Everything that we see, every physical thing that we see in the universe, all the stars and planets and dark matter and dark energy, everything that we can physically describe, was, if you take it and run it backwards, it was smaller, it was all packed into a point smaller than what we could see.
In fact, no dimension.
No dimension. Okay.
even that didn't exist at one point.
I'm going to take one more, and then I'm going to keep going. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, we live in an age where we understand that the universe is constructed such that matter and energy can swap state.
Mm-hmm.
But there's still a finite nature to what we live in. Not an ever-expanding in terms of adding more matter and adding more energy. We understand the laws of conservation. Nothing new is getting added to the universe. Transitioning is shape, but it's still a finite fixed sense.
Right.
And so you can't really have nothingness logically. You can only think that what we have and all that we observe about our universe could either be equal to or a very tiny subset of what really exists outside that realm, because laws of cause and effect, you cannot have a big bang out of nothing, no mind, no existence beyond our universe. You can probably more reliably infer that the universe, as great as it is to us, is a tiny subset of what brought it in.
Very good. Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm going, so that's brilliant. Dan, quickly.
To me, it's very simple that I'm sort of say that, but everything is starting from that point of view, it suggests. God put all these programs and everything in it. The same thing is when a baby is born. She doesn't take or she anything from money. It's all the programs already got put in there. How he's going to develop it. We can say, well, how did you know he had the back 5 things and all that? It's already programmed there. God programmed the universe that way.
Okay, I'm going to do one more definition, and then I'm going to ask a question related to what you're saying. This is more of a mathematical definition, Alex Valenkin, nothingness equals a closed spherical space-time of zero radius. How's that? What's wrong? Is there anything wrong with that definition?
Yeah, we did at some point.
Why is it spherical to sub-spherical?
It still has things you can describe about it. It's still in space-time. He's describing a radius, even if it's zero. It's still something. Here's a logical statement. A, nothing exists. B, for every X, it is not the case that X exists. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don.
I'll give you the scriptural response. In the beginning, when God began to create, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. So he brought everything out of nothing.
Right. All right. Now, here's another one. Absolute nothingness is a state in which there are no features which can be, or ever possibly could be, positively described.
You can't talk about it.
That's pretty good.
Again, that implies an observer to be able to make those descriptions.
That's correct.
Now, one of the things as we go through this that kind of sticks in my mind is if we're trying to focus on this time. We have this half dimension of time that has a beginning and goes infinitely in one direction only. But we recognize that God existing before the universe is something, and he works in a presumably bidirectional time that goes in both directions. So he has his own time space and probably dimension space that exists before the universe. This is not something apart of or visible for our use.
Right. This. This was mine. I wrote this one at the end of the chapter when I tried to define it myself. There's a couple of problems with it, but that's the best I could do with it. Yes?
I don't mean to be blasphemous, but regarding this nothingness...
Tear it up. It's okay. I'm no philosopher.
Then would God be nothing?
Well, remember, we're talking here within the realm of secular science. How can they explain something from nothing?
In Proverbs 8, when he speaks of before all things I was one brought up with him, before the mountain, before the sea, before everything, there was nothing.
Good.
God said, Jesus, basically God speaks of Jesus, before all things I was one brought up with him, I was a daily delight. So basically, before the time, before everything, that's what he's speaking of, right?
Right. So, let me The question really is, can nothing really exist? And the corollary question, could something have come from absolutely nothing? Without God? Could something have come? If you take, I mean, and you know, at first when I first started reading this, I thought, well, nothing, it's an easy definition. And then I started reading it, and it really is hard to define. Take away matter, energy, space, and time. Imagine that, and you're still, your own consciousness is part of what you're imagining. You're trying to imagine a picture of nothing, and yet you're still there looking at it. Yes. Okay. The question really becomes then, if nothing could come from nothing, if something could not come from nothing, where did what we have come from? Now, if I were not a believer, how would you convince me that it was God, which is a personal, creative being versus some random force that was there that we don't understand? Tim?
Yeah, in order for there to be anything at all, it has to be something that's uncreated. In other words, an atheist would have to go through some sort of mindless laws of, you know, I think Hawking does it, you know, like gravity is there, so therefore,
that's very interesting. Let me read a paragraph out of here, because it's exactly what this is the author's quote. He's not quoting someone else. Suppose we take the laws of general relativity, which govern cosmic evolution on the largest scale, and extrapolate them backward in time toward the beginning of the universe. This is the answer to your singularity question. As we watch the evolution of our expanding and cooling cosmos in reverse, we would see its contents contracting and growing hotter. At T equals zero, the moment of the Big Bang, the temperature, density, and curvature of the universe all go to infinity. Here, the equations of relativity break down. They become meaningless. We have reached a singularity, a boundary or edge to space-time itself, a point at which all causal lines converge. Now listen to this last sentence. He says, if there is a cause for this event, it must transcend space-time and hence escape the reach of science.
And who does that say?
Jim Holt, the author, who at the end of the book leaves the question open.
So is that as close as he gets?
That's as close as he gets. But so the question becomes, okay, he's saying... Right. He's saying there's no nothing. What he's trying to figure out is what the cause of it is. And he's saying, whatever the cause is, it must transcend the universe. So the question becomes, here's my question to the class. Why should we believe, from a scientific standpoint, put away the Bible for a second, give me scientific answers. Why should we believe in a conscious, creative being, person, God, versus some materialistic, random forces or laws governed by science? What is it about what we see here, the world that we have, the universe that we have, that leads us one direction or the other?
Random causes don't create orderly things. If a tornado goes through and rips everything up, it's not going to leave a mansion where it went through, because even though it's possible, random chances never do.
Warren.
Science and logic are not separate. Science employs logic, and science and logic are a continuum.
Do you think logic is transcendent of the universe?
And I
But the Kalam argument, William Lane Craig did a doctoral thesis on it. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. And the universe began to exist. Therefore, there is a cause.
But why is that cause God rather than some kind of natural forces?
Well, it's some kind of creative force. Now we can have further discussion.
Well, I think one of the things that you always said talks about is the fine tuning. So unlikely that a natural force could be responsible for it. You just put in the balance, you know, the likelihood of that happening.
That's where I want to go. Why should we, if you look at an automobile and you look at a rock, what is it about the automobile that allows you to know that it was designed and the rock was put together by natural law? Now, you know, you've read about cars being built. You know where they're built. You haven't, you've seen pictures of it on TV. But what is it about the automobile if you had never seen one before? You would look at that and study it and say, somebody put this together. This is not the result of natural forces.
Well, you have to infer it, and you have to say that, you know, when you look at the evidence, it's going to draw you to a conclusion one way or the other on whether there's a personality. Because you have to look at, therefore, to trace a personality, you have to say, is there purpose in what is coming together?
Well, you can say there's...
Does randomness... Randomness does not.
Okay, so...
And so, therefore, there's also a lot of purposes and a lot of commonality in the world around us. Common designs for different purposes.
But what is it about an...
Like the car, you know it's a Ford, you know it's a Chevy, just by the characteristics of it, the way that the personality of the firm, if you will, puts their product out to serve a purpose.
But what is it about... the engineering of a car or a computer that allows you, yes, that's right. The part, the a rock can be this big or this big or any size. It can have a whole bunch of different kinds of material in it. It's still a rock. This book, this computer, your car, the parts in the car are highly specified. If you take a radiator and you make it out of the wrong material, or it's the wrong size, it doesn't fit, it doesn't work. The parts all fit together, they're all highly specified, and the bottom line of that is it contains information. There is information in there. There's not much information in a rock, but the information in a computer or a car, the parts are all highly specified. Now, what about the universe is highly specified? John?
First, no matter how you get around it, something cannot come from nothing on its own. Period. Then you deal with fine tuning, which is what you're asking. Whenever you see a machine and all the hundreds of parts or thousands of parts are all finely tuned to accomplish a given purpose.
Right.
In the case of a car, to transport human beings. The universe, we know there's over 1,000 finely tuned parameters beyond comprehension that are all finely tuned for what we have found a common purpose, to make a planet capable of supporting us. Their fine tuning all points to that particular purpose.
Right.
And only a mind of a person fine tunes stuff to all accomplish a given purpose. Never been without a mind, never will, never be without a mind.
Okay, so, Ted.
The counter argument to that statement, which we have to be able to grapple with and answer, is purpose doesn't exist. There is no purpose, that it just is. There is no purpose of all this fine tuning coming together to make us appreciate God. So that's, we have to present a counter argument.
Well, my counter-argument to that would be, they say that when we say God did it, that that's a discussion stopper, that the argument ends there. When they say it just is, that's a discussion stopper in exactly the same way. why is it? We're talking about unbelievably impossible odds for it to just be. Okay? So, in our common everyday experience, everything that we have that's highly specified, that fits together in a particular way, that wouldn't work if the parts weren't specified, is created by a mind. So we look at the universe, and by analogy, we can say it all fits together without all these parameters exactly perfectly right. We wouldn't be here talking about it. That implies a creator with a consciousness and the power to do, to put that stuff together. Okay? I've got about 10 minutes and I want to finish. I'm going to ask on somebody that hasn't. Mara.
And it also shows a personality, a person. We have the mind, like the mind of God. Why would we have all of these attributes? From where? You know, a personal relationship, this information that's in it, a mind that's like the divine mind. Why do we deal with, act this way? Because it comes from a person.
Right.
Consciousness, awareness.
But if you go to Romans 1, 13 and 14, you'll see that God said, everything that I made, visible, is proof.
Good. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit because Tim, I want to call on you because I want to hear what you have to say. Go ahead.
Well, okay. The one point that I think might be a good comeback on that, too, is that you have the two choices. You have to have something that's eternal, that's non-created, that's a brute fact, either in your mind or in your non-mind, whatever. If an atheist goes, well, it's got to be some sort of force or non-mind thing, it's a natural thing. Why wouldn't the universe have always existed then? Because if it automatically produces it, why is it only 13.7 billion years ago that it came into existence?
But it still does not. You could do the multiverse thing with that.
But anyway, you can't go back at it. You can't go to infinity.
Right.
A point where this all begins.
But at some point you still have to answer the information and complexity argument. Okay, okay. So we've gotten to the point where we agree, I think, as a class, that the idea of absolute nothingness is philosophically, scientifically not possible. That there has to be something transcendent of the universe for the universe to come into existence, and that the universe, by the characteristics of it that we see, seem to imply that it was designed by a creator that is conscious, that can make choices, and is powerful enough to implement all of this. Okay, so I'm going to really completely change gears here because I want to go to a much more personal aspect of this. Talk about myself. When I became a Christian, this is where I would stop the arguments for a long time. They were up here in my head. Then I wanted to make this all more personal. I wanted God to fulfill the promises that He made that are in the Bible. And I want to talk for 10 minutes about my journey in that. Now, there's a couple of things in this book that I want to read because this guy is still struggling with this stuff. His question is, without God, without something transcendent, where does it, if we believe the science, where does it leave us? And I want to read two things. This is a book called, this is quoted in this book from a book called The Tragic Sense of Life by Miguel de Unamuno. I must confess, painful as the confession may be, that even in the days of my youth's simple faith, I never was made to tremble by descriptions of hellfire, no matter how terrible. For I felt always that the idea of nothingness was much more terrifying than hell. Whoever suffers lives, and whoever lives in suffering still loves and hopes, even though over the portal of his abode is written, abandon all hope. and it is better to live in pain than peacefully cease to be at all. The truth is that I could not believe in this atrocious hell, an eternity of punishment, nor could I imagine a more authentic hell than that of nothingness and the prospect of it. It's pretty powerful. One more, a little more contemporary. Today, the most uncompromising opponent of cosmic optimism may be Woody Allen. In an interview he gave in 2010 to a Catholic priest, curiously enough, Allen spoke of the, quote, overwhelming bleakness of the universe. Quote, human existence is a brutal experience to me, he said. It is a brutal, meaningless experience, an agonizing, meaningless experience with some oases, delight, some charm and peace, but these are just small oases. There is no justice to it, Allen maintained, and no rationality either. Everyone does what one can to alleviate, quote, the agony of the human condition. Some chase money or love. Allen himself makes films and whines. Quote, I do get a certain amount of solace from whining, he says. Yet in the end, everyone goes to his grave in a meaningless way. That's what the human condition is without, if we just believe the science, without God. So I want to go to some Bible verses. Before I joined this class, before I got to know Dr. Ross and understood where he was coming from, I did not have the intellectual, philosophical underpinnings to be able to say to God, this is what I want from you. Because I was still wrestling with, does he really exist? Is he the Christian God? All of those questions that we still have. But the argument that we made this morning about there needing to be a creator God to make sense of what we see, and looking at the Bible and science, and the God that the Bible describes seems to be the one that is reflected in the world of nature. That gave me the footing, the background, the basis, the underpinnings to be able to take the step and say, this is what I want from you. Now, I don't know how many of you are in Sunday morning service, how many people listen to the pastor this morning. He's giving a 7-part series on something I've never heard a pastor teach on before, and that's emotions. And so this sort of fits in with that. I don't know if your journey's like mine, but this is where I went now after I'm able to say, yes, there's a God. I want you. And I'm pretty demanding of God because he makes these promises, and this is what I want. I don't want it just in my head. I don't want just this theory about who God is,
right,
and something. It's like another theory about how the sun burns or how, you know, biology works. I don't need that. I need something that feeds me in my darkest times, the times when I'm lonely, that really keeps me going. So I just want to go through some of these verses. We've only got a couple of minutes, but they're so amazing. Talking about emotions and how he should feed us and how we should be feeling. Psalm 16:11, you make known to me the path of life. You will fill me with joy in your presence, with eternal pleasures at your right hand. Now I want you to read these like you've never read them before. If you're like me, you'll see that, gloss over it, and you go on to the next one. Listen to the passion. Listen to the feelings that are in here, the depth of what the author is talking about. Psalm 35, again, David. For his anger lasts only a moment, but his favor lasts a lifetime. Weeping may stay for the night, but rejoicing comes in the morning. Isaiah 35:10. And those the Lord has rescued will return. They will enter Zion with singing. Everlasting joy will crown their heads. Gladness and joy will overtake them, and sorrow and sighing will flee away. It doesn't just say they will be happy and have gladness. It says gladness and joy will overtake them. How deep is that? That's what I want. That's what I want as a Christian.
Doesn't this infer in the afterlife?
I think it's both. And especially the Old Testament passages, they were talking about right now. John 16:24. Until now you have not asked for anything in my name. Ask, this is Jesus speaking, ask and you will receive, and your joy will be complete.
Right. Right. Amen.
Complete joy, not just joy.
Right.
Romans 14:17. For the kingdom of God is not a matter of eating and drinking, but of righteousness, peace, and joy in the Holy Spirit.
Right.
Doesn't say the problems are going to go away. Doesn't say it's going to be any easier for us. In many ways it's harder. But our relationship with God, this is what we are promised. And I, for one, am bugging God all the time. Because I'm personally not satisfied with a intellectual Christian life. I want this.
Good.
Romans 8:6. The mind governed by the flesh is death, but the mind governed by the Spirit is life and peace. Isaiah 26:3, you will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in you. John 14:27, this is fabulous. Listen to this. You've heard it 100 times, but listen to it. Peace I leave with you, my peace I give you. I do not give to you as the world gives. It's not good enough. Do not let your hearts be troubled and do not be afraid. Don't let your hearts be troubled with all the stuff that happens in life. Don't let your hearts be troubled. Now, how does that happen? I can talk personally again. For me, it's two ways. Part of it is intellectual. The fact that I know that I have a relationship with God and that I trust Him and that I know that He has my best interests at heart, even though I don't understand it, I can trust Him. But even that's not enough for me. The second way that it happens is when the Holy Spirit talks to you directly, when God speaks to you directly, and that peace that passes all understanding comes to you in the hardest, worst, most miserable times. Well, that's a big question. I would say the first thing that comes to mind is somebody who has a wonderful relationship with the Lord and they eat bad, you know, their body's still going to fall apart faster than somebody who eats well. So I think it's all tied together. I think it's all the same.
Could you repeat the passage from Psalms about the peace and the warmth?
This one? For his anger.
Anger lasts only a moment. I have a problem with nighttime. It's like getting kind of depressed in the brain. Especially when I start getting drowsy and I can't do things that I want to do. But in the morning I feel refreshed and good. Ready to tackle life.
Yeah, it's that way for me sometimes too. The end of the day, at night, it's the hardest time, and that's when I have to go to the Lord and say, you know, I really want your peace and I want your joy, because I am incapable of it. I have told you these things, this is John 16:33, I have told you these things so that in me you may have peace. In this world, you will have trouble, but take heart, I have overcome the world. Job 22:21, submit to God and be at peace with Him. In this way, prosperity will come to you. Philippians, disappeared. All right. 11.
That was a mistake.
All right. You're right. And that was the last one anyway. So there you go. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it. Yeah, let's close in prayer.
Yeah, let's do that.
talking about the Lord is not enough.
You're right.
That's right.
You're right. Jesus, oh God, thank you so much for the understanding you give us of this wide, wide world that you've given us and how it leads us to a personal, intimate relation with you. Understanding it without that relationship, I don't think is, it's not satisfying and it's not where you want us to stop. So I ask for me and for everyone here that we take the next step, we humble ourselves, fall on our face in front of you, Lord, and say, I can't do it, I need your help. The only peace I can get, real peace I can get, is from you. I thank you so much for this class and everyone in it. And ask your blessing on everyone today as we go our way. In Jesus' name, amen.